in chapter 6, verse 1, we have another question, a response from these gals that are called the daughters of Jerusalem, which were attendants on the harem of Solomon. Amplified reads this way, "Where is your beloved gone, O you fairest among women? Where is your beloved hiding himself? For we would seek him with you." Which, of course, again, is another reaffirmation of the fact that Solomon could not be the hero of the book. Okay? Now, the Shulamite woman replies in verses 2 and 3, and the indication there is of the pastoral rural atmosphere that she and this young man were from, and also a reaffirmation of their complete harmony and identity with each other, the security that brought them. Verse 2, she replied, "My beloved is going down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He feeds among the lilies which grow there." And what you have are some pastoral trophies in these two verses. Agricultural and pastoral. They're figures of speech. And apparently, throughout the book, you have this concept of a garden, spices, lilies, concept of a rural atmosphere. And what she's saying is that he is going back to that rural setting. Now, in verse 3, she reaffirms the security that they find in their soul identity. "I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine." In other words, there was a rapport identity there which has brought great stability and security to her soul and to his. And she reaffirms this to all these gals of the harem. Okay? The Shulamite lover is apparently a very mature person, a very dependable person. So this brings us to another principle that I'd like to share. And I have number 25 on this. Is this 26? Okay. Is that right? Okay. If you're new here, these principles relate to male-female relationships. What she is saying actually in verse 2 is that they have a very mature relationship. The separation that has been caused by her being inveigled or being lured into the situation she's in now has not broken down their loyalty to each other at all. They're very mature, dependable people. Well, the principle that I would like to make out of this is this. I was going to say, do not marry. Well, okay, I'll say it that way. That's the way I have it down. Do not marry. Most young people here probably aren't thinking about getting married. Well, maybe they are. I don't know. All the girls are. Do not marry a child. Do not marry a child, or you will have to raise a child. You will have to raise a child. Which means that you have to know what a man is and what a woman is. The other side of the coin. Now, I don't know where you get that kind of training except in the Bible. I have a series on what a man is that I utilize in the wilderness with high school boys from the scriptures. But if you do not know what a man is or what a woman is before you get married, well, you may be in for a lot of confusion. I think that every woman has a mother instinct to her. And many times a woman just gets a gal in trouble. She'll marry a guy because she feels sorry for him. Or he needs a mother image, and she finds that she fulfills that image, and so she sort of becomes a mother instead of a wife. One of the sorriest situations that you could ever find is when you have a mother-type wife and a child-type husband, where she is mothering him all the time instead of being his wife. Do not marry a man because you feel sorry for him. Do not marry a woman because you feel sorry for her. Now that means that some believers will have to wait longer to marry than others. The key to this do not marry business is to wait for maturation. And you get in a hurry about this and you may regret it on down the road, I'll guarantee you. Wait for maturation. There's another principle. There's three principles that I want to bring relative to this point. Principle number 27. Enduring one another. Enduring one another is miserable. Right man, right woman, must have capacity. They do have capacity. They have capacity to enjoy one another. And hence, come to fullness in marriage. Now it appears that this is the kind of relationship this young man and this young woman had in this book. They were not just putting up with each other. When they went out on a date, they didn't have to have narcotics of some time or some speed pills or something to make them high. They enjoyed one another's company. Okay? Principle number 28. Before you marry, before you're even engaged, before you become engaged, you should have utmost confidence You should have utmost confidence that you are right man, right woman. Now that confidence will be a soul confidence, you see. If for some reason you have to be apart, it's not going to bust you up too much. You know that your relationship is secure enough with this person. It's not going to tear you apart, this type of thing. Now, this is the expression of the Shulamite woman in verse 3. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He feeds among the lilies. He finds his sustenance and his source of life in a rural, pastoral atmosphere. And what she's really saying in these verses is that he identifies with that kind of life. He works there. He finds his life source there. Another reason that it could not be Solomon. Okay? Now apparently, during this whole discussion, Solomon has entered this room. And the Shulamite woman has very passionately described her lover in the latter part of chapter 5, and he apparently had seen this. So the Amplified adds in italics in verse 4, during the discussion, King Solomon had entered the room and heard the impassioned defense of the shepherd by the animated Shulamite, whose fervor had only been intensified by her consciousness of his presence, of Solomon's presence. Filled with admiration for her and yet aware of a strength of purpose in her before which he was helpless, he listened until she had finished her speech, and then he said, okay? Solomon now is going to make another pitch in verses 4 through 9. You are as beautiful as Tirzah, Amplified adds, the capital of northern Israel's first king. That doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Verse 4. Tirzah is a place name for the capital of the Canaanites. It's a Canaanite capital. The Canaanite capital in northern Palestine. And it had a beautiful setting. The mountains in northern Palestine vary anywhere from 1,800 feet till you get up to Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is right at 10,000 feet. So that you have sort of rolling countryside. Galilee is a very beautiful place, charming place. And Tirzah was that type of a town. She would know that. Later, this becomes the capital, as the Amplified says, of Jeroboam. See? When Solomon died and the kingdom splits, it becomes the capital of Jeroboam the First. Okay? She would know what he was talking about because she was from that part of the country. She was a Shulamite from Shunem. So he says in verse 4, "You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my love. You are as comely as the Jerusalem, but you are as terrible as a bannered host." Now, the word terrible there means majestic. Like an army ready for battle. Now apparently her eyes were really flashing. By now she's getting quite frustrated. And so like an army with the banners raised, she's been angered by all that's transpired. And she has a certain majesty about her, like any woman when she's very angry. I kind of enjoy to see a woman when she's angry. Strength of character. I really do. Particularly if I'm teasing her and she gets angry, then it's all the better. Her strength of character appears, and it's always nice to listen to how she's going to respond. This gal was really angry, and she had black hair, probably had black eyes, dark eyes anyhow. So in verse 5, he says, "Turn away your flashing eyes from me, for they have overcome me." King James says, "Turn away your eyes from me." Yeah, same translation. What he really says is, "Turn your eyes from me." Apparently she gave him some pretty bad looks at this time. "For they cause me to be awed. They cause me to be awed." This is another Hifil stem here. The word is hirabuni, like this in English. But the source word for this is the word Rahab. Just like spelled just like Rahab the harlot. Rahab. See? This is the source. Rahab. And you have this is a Hifil stem, see, of Rahab. And a Hifil stem in Greek is causative active. Causative active. And her eyes are flashing. And she looks at him and she's really angry, you know, and it just, he gets daggers and he says, "Turn your eyes away from me. They cause me to be awed." Rahab means to abash. To awe. So he's kind of overwhelmed by the look on her face. This woman looked right through Solomon. She was probably glaring at him at this time. And so he says, "Look away." And then he's going to go into another physical description. Okay? Very similar to his other pitch. Okay, there's a principle here. Principle number 29. Principle 29. This is something that there's been a lot more honesty about in this day than when I was a young person. The eyes are the windows of the soul. The eyes are the windows of the soul. Okay? You speak with your eyes. You speak with your eyes. Now, the point is that she never told Solomon more with her eyes than she did with her lips. That's the point here, see? She never told Solomon more with her eyes than her lips. Okay. But Solomon goes on. He's aggressive. My saying this in this regard, we had a person in his church that had a very serious growth, a tumor on somewhere on the brain area, and she's having headaches, and went to a doctor, an eye doctor, Paul Kimball, and he immediately looked at her. When he looked in her eyes, he knew she had some very serious problem. He could read that in her eyes, and it was through that they discovered this tumor and were able to operate and save this person's life. The eyes are the windows of the soul. I sent somebody else to see him one time, and this person was having emotional problems. The first thing he said when he looked at this person, he says, "You're having some serious problems." He said, what's bothering you? First thing he said. Which means don't cancel your next appointment at Dr. Kimball, because he's a good eye doctor. The eyes are the windows of the soul. And much of what troubles us, particularly in our soul, will be reflected in our eyes. Same way with the joy of the soul. When there's great joy in our soul, it'll be manifest in our eyes. You see? Very natural, responsive part of the physical body, to the spiritual side of the body. Well, Solomon is going to go on. He's aggressive. He has great poise about himself. And he's going to give a pitch very similar to the one that he gave in chapter 4. He repeats almost the same thing. Okay, let's start at verse 5. "Turn away your flashing eyes from me, for they have overcome me. They have awed me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that trail down from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes coming from their washing." Meaning they were clean. Each is paired. They're in twins. None are missing, you see. Each is paired and none of them is missing. "Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate behind your veil." The King James translates the temples there. It means the high part of her facial structure, her cheeks. Apparently she had one of those peaches and cream type complexion. Okay? And Solomon is going into this same pitch that he had before. All right, let's pick up another principle here. Principle number 30. Principle number 30. Good personal hygiene is it E-I-N-E? I-E-N-E. Right, I before E, except after C, or when sounded as A, as a neighbor and slave. Hygiene. I think that's right. I'm the world's worst speller. I had a gal who was a German. She wasn't a German. She was a German teacher. And her name was Miss Bobby Edmondson, which immediately pegs her as being raised in the South. Because she had the name Bobby. You know, Bobby Joe, Bobby, et cetera, et cetera. Got these double names on it. And She's a tremendous woman, one of the great influences in my life. And she taught English in a seminary. She's the most unappreciated person there. You know, everybody studying for the ministry says, "What do I need to study that stuff for?" And she made me learn all those rules. I still know those rules. I don't know how to spell, but I know the rules. Okay, good personal hygiene and physical habits relative to the body, are stimulated by the doctrine of right man, right woman. Not discouraged. You know, you have BO, you never take a shower, your feet stink, you wear dirty socks, and you say, "Oh well, when God sends my right woman, she'll like that." When I was in the service, the guy that bunked under me, he was a lifeguard at he moonlighted on a lifeguard job, and he never washed his socks. And I'll tell you, I knew when that guy, I'd be sleeping, but I knew when he came in and went to bed, whether I woke up or not. And when he got to bed, I'd get up, and I'd get his socks, and I'd take his footlocker. We always left them open. We were in a pretty good thing. And I'd take that top shelf out and put his socks down under, put the top shelf on and close his footlocker, so I wouldn't have to smell those things all night. It doesn't speak well of you or your mind if you dress sloppily or if you pick your nose in public. You never, you know, I'm a humble Christian. I never shine my shoes. Shows how humble I am. You tell everyone you're Irish by the green on your teeth, that type of thing. You don't have a healthy mind, and no reason anybody should want to associate with you. And I tell you, one thing corrects that. A minute that a girl looks twice at a guy, and he knows she looked twice at him, that's going to start the correction right there. He'll be combing his hair. He'll almost look like a member of the human race sometimes. The improvement will be so great. It's just great to see what happens when the influence, the healthy influence that two people have on when they really get interested in each other. Now it's when they get overly familiar with each other that they can lose some of that, you know. And then they don't care. It should never happen to two human beings that are right man, right woman. I want to smell nice for my wife. I don't want to be stinky around her. I want her to like my hair the way I groom my hair. That doesn't mean that she's going to change much there. I mean, I'll probably groom it the way I'm going to groom it the rest of my life, but I want her to like it. I hope she likes it, you see. I think that's healthy. And this gal, apparently, now in the next chapter we have a much more intimate description of her, so she apparently was really in good shape, you know, took care of herself. Okay, she had good symmetry, her bone structure, coloring in her face apparently was breathtaking. Now in verse 8, Solomon seems to, he's going to compare her again with the harem, just like he was doing in chapter 4. See, this is his frame of reference. He's practicing all this comparative physical anatomy all the time. He gets all the latest sex magazines. Hugh Hefner's Playboy sent to his palace, and he's got Hui, is that it? Hui, or whatever it is, the French name. I read all those covers at a distance. I I have enough trouble with hormones. I don't have to be opening the things, but they got so many of them now. He makes a reference. He's going to make a comparison with her with his harem in verse 8. Okay. I want to show you something here. I want to show you some interpretations. One here and one in another place. They're so ludicrous. Well, this one isn't too ludicrous, but at least it shows how some people are thinking about the book. Solomon now begins to brag about his record, and he has the queens. Now, the queens would be his wives, and he says there are 60 of them, 60 wives. Okay? The concubines, he says there are 80. So these are 80 what I would call playthings. These are his playthings. And then the virgins, the King James, here's where King James takes the word alamoth, alma in the plural, and translates it virgins. They maybe they were, maybe they weren't. I kind of think they were. I think they're kind of candidates for the harem. These are, he says there, they are without number, so they're uncounted. Uncounted. Attendants. And I kind of think they're maybe candidates, hopefully, in their own mentalities, because they do a lot of speaking in the book relative to their relationship to Solomon, their identity with him. Now, the Amplified has an interesting footnote here, and I'd like to read it to you. Listen to this. Obviously, Solomon wrote this book and the statement before us prior to the time when, in his more degenerate years, he had his full number of 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, I always respond to little statements like that, and I always write something in case when I die, why somebody might read what I wrote, my kids or something like that, you know. I wrote a statement here. I wrote, not necessarily. Do the translators of the Amplified feel that 60 queens and 80 concubines is less degenerative than 700 and 300? You know, if you have more than one, you're starting down the road, and I don't know if you have 60 plus 80. How much more degenerate is it to have 300 plus, or 300 and 700? I mean, you just change the figures a little bit.